We come together today with that audacious, bold declaration that where two or three are gathered, where we are gathered, there'll be some truth. Doesn't mean that the truth will come from me. It doesn't mean that I have the truth. Doesn't mean that you have the truth. But somehow or other, because we're here together, the truth will manifest itself through us, to us, for us. Over the last 3 days, we've been considering some things about America. We've been considering things about America largely through my eyes, which are, some people would like to think that these glasses have funny tints, and hence what I see is very peculiar. So you have to take everything I say with a grain of salt. I know you will anyway, but I'm just letting you know that I have to take it with a grain of salt too. And therefore, let's review briefly where we are, where we've been, and the way it comes out today will probably not sound completely familiar because it might not be right where I was yesterday. First, we talked about America being a realm in which the whole notion of necessity has been defined in such a way that it's really out of kilter. We have blown up the realm of necessity, of what is necessary for survival, until it's almost become infinite. And the things we want for survival then are infinite. And I've been saying that our wants are created to a large extent, not by our being, not by the image of God in us, but by our culture. They're the result of what has happened to us, what we cause each other to want. And that most of the realm of necessity is an idolatrous realm. So that most of the things we do to earn a living, to supply the realm of necessity for other people, is a very ambiguous, questionable doing, if we think about it, at least as I think about it. And I therefore assert we really do not choose what we want. If it's the we who's choosing, if it's in some sense a very deep we, we're so conditioned, and here Skinner is right, we have been so conditioned that we want what the culture needs us to want in order to keep its life going. And I think it's quite an idolatrous life, so we are conditioned to want some things which really don't serve our deepest needs. Needs now being defined not in terms of what we want, but in terms of some image of God in us, a created nature, a created intention on the part of God. So that my first proposition is that we need to scale down drastically the realm of necessity. We just don't know how to handle it, and there's no way to even begin to handle it until you can scale it down. And then you can begin to think about what it might be if it were different. So then we buy less, labor less, and have more time for something else. Secondly, I said that we are under the tyranny, that's under the tyranny of necessity, under the tyranny of the new. We think the new is better than the old. And we think that we ought to really prepare every day for the future, and that everything we do ought to have some connection with the future, which has a kind of infinite extension. And sometimes I think I've been going to school all my life getting ready for some future. And I'm sure that most people spend up till, if they're professionals at all, up till they're about 30 getting ready to live. And if you're a wife in that situation, you really have some feelings, at least the graduate student wives I have contact with, who never really get located until a person is 30. And lots of times, I went back to school as a graduate student at 32 with four kids. I was 35 before I started out. And I started, I'd had a kind of interim, but you're still preparing. And I think we're under a tyranny to make and shape our world. Now, yesterday we had quite a discussion of this as to whether because I used the word creativity, I said we're under the tyranny of self-creation. And I've been thinking about it ever since. And let me just formulate it again. I said at the end, to be faithful is to receive the world, to accept life as a gift before we begin to make and shape it. It is more to be shaped than to shape. It is to listen and ponder our roots rather than focus on the future. It's to constitute oneself in the light of being constituted by another. It is to create art out of grateful acceptance of our being. Our being as being somehow present because of the source of our being. This summer, for example, I haven't painted at all. And I guess I feel some compulsion to paint, that is to create. I've got all the stuff here. You know, stretchers and canvas, and we loaded it all up here and haven't looked at it. Haven't done anything with it. But I haven't felt like painting. And I think some of our creation is for the sake of the creation. And I don't know whether I'm speaking any truth or any reality, but I could feel I just had to create. But I guess I create or want to feel that creation comes out of some meaning. And if I have something I really want to express, then I should create something. Therefore, I should draw, or I paint, or make something, that it becomes an expression of meaning. When Yendi was murdered, I spent the whole next day, I didn't do anything except paint a picture which expressed let my feelings come out, and tried to say something. Now, I guess really what I'm trying to say is that culture, as the creation of man, as a continually new creation, is a means of disclosure. It's a symbol. Creativity, creative objects are symbols. They are symbols of being. They are symbols of meaning. They are symbols of God, if you will, rather than somehow autonomous creations. So another way to put it would be less emphasis on the creating and more on the content, that is on the symbolization, rather than on the material, that is the material mediating something, rather than on the form, on the meaning rather than on the form. One of my mentors said that religion is the substance of culture and culture is the form of religion. And I guess what I'm trying to say is whatever creativity takes place ought to express religion. That is, it ought to be the outgrowth of some very deep feelings and meanings, and therefore have a content, so that art or creativity is a combination of form and content. And I think that we get hung up a lot in thinking that the form is what's important, and therefore we ought to go through the motions of creating something, whether or not it's expressing any meaning for us. So maybe what I'm saying is, what is emphasized is not the new as new, not the created or the creative as creative, but the new or the creation as a symbol of being and meaning, or of God. I don't know if that's at all helpful, but that's my rethinking of what we were saying 2 days ago and what we discussed yesterday. And yesterday we talked about the order of life, or the form in which we decide about life, how we think about shaping our life together. And I said that to be faithful as a Christian is to begin with God and humanity rather than with ourselves. What I was trying to deal with is the American image of kind of isolated individuals deciding for themselves on the basis of their own feelings what is important to be. The notion of freedom, maybe first of the week we can have a session on freedom. We've had some in the last 3 or 4 weeks. But it's the notion of freedom is self-initiation, where the emphasis is upon the interacting of self-initiations. And I think, and I've thought for a long time, that this image is really un-Christian. That a Christian is a slave of Christ. He is captured by a vision of humanity, by a vision of what it means to be human, and he's a slave of that. And therefore he's informed by something, which means if he chooses, he chooses under the guiding image or under the guiding reality of something other than simply what he wants. And the Christian community gathers together to try to help people form and shape that image. So it isn't simply somebody's subjectivity that determines what is good. I have real problems with the subjectivity that functions in our believing. You know, Luther said you got to do your own believing just as you got to do your own dying, but what you believe is not an individual subjective thing. That's the church trying to hammer out what one believes. And the same with democracy, or the same with our economic life. So that the fundamental image that's American is of this individual creating his own life, his own career, his own being, maybe with a few other people, one other person perhaps, and then a few children for a while, but it's creating his own, and soon you got to slough them off, and they got to get their families and become individual centers. And I guess I'm trying to say that the primitive societies had some real value that we need to consider, and because it's primitive doesn't mean it's bad, or because it's new doesn't mean it's good or progressive, in which there was an extended family, in which the community, in which the we and the us were more important than the I and the me. And again, you have to see my thinking as dialectical. It isn't either or, but in our society, it's all I and me. Now, all. Well, that's an overstatement. But it's only for the sake of trying to lift up what's the dominating image in our society. I think it's the I and the me and not the we and the us. And I think in Christian faith, it's the we and the us. It's the body of Christ. It's the body image that Paul holds up. And not the kind of isolated individual. We are parts of each other, like the body has arms and legs and eyes and ears, hands and feet. Well, I think maybe I'll change my format today and finish it off before we have our discussion. That is, I'll take up the topic for today. Usually we've discussed the last topic, so maybe you won't get as much chance. I'll try to kind of run through it lightly. Today I want to talk about what we are and what we think we are and what we might be by looking at the notion of the relation of the sacred and the profane, of the church and the world, of the church and the state, of the way we look at that relationship. I think is very crucial. I think what we are in fact, what we've done in fact, is to identify faith with the tyrannous realm of necessity, or what Marcuse would call with the realm of excess repression, namely that we have simply sold out the possibility of joy and freedom from necessity for an excess attention to necessity. And that's what he means by repression. We have postponed enjoyment using it very, we have postponed our freedom to be until we retire, instead of reducing a realm of necessity so that we could, what, retire when we're born. We have identified our faith then with this realm of necessity. We have said to serve this realm of necessity is what is demanded of the Christian. He is a faithful servant in the society which is overplayed necessity. And that's what it means to be faithful. A second identification is with the creation of the new for its own sake, with what I now call autonomous creativity. That is, it's creativity which is for its own sake. It's to be creative. Somehow it's good, regardless of what the meaning of the creativity is, what it expresses, what it symbolizes, what it embodies, what it participates in, the ground of its the meaning, the content. In other words, it's like art for art's sake. We're creative for the sake of creativity, and I think some of us, I know I've bought into that. I really want to speak for myself. I've bought into this tyrannous effort to serve a realm of necessity. Not as much a lot of other people, but still a great deal. The same with creativity. We have identified our faith with self-initiation, with democracy, and with a pursuit of self-interest in economic life. We have identified our Christian faith. We say that any other form is not Christian. As someone pointed out here, I think it was Barb Rossing, in the Middle Ages, the Christian state was had a king, and it was a monarchy, and that was called a Christian state. But we have identified it with democracy, and we've identified our faith with the pursuit of self-interest in economic life. That's what we've done in fact. That is, to seek one's own economic gain is to serve Christ. Now, in theory, I think, we have a different view of things. I think in theory, we are moving more and more toward what I'd call an eschatological emphasis in our faith, rather than a historical emphasis. In other words, in our theory, we have said that faith really does not have much to do with the profane, that is, with the world. As we have separated the sacred and the profane in our theory. So we have a kind of a myth. I don't want to use the myth, though, because the myth can be very positive. We have an ideology. That can be positive, negative, too, so I don't know what word to use. But what I say is, what we think we are is that we have separated the sacred and the profane. And I've studied this for years. That is, where we have separated the sacred and the profane, what happens is the profane creeps in and takes over the sacred and gives the content to the sacred. We thought in our theory, or we have affirmed in our theory, that the church and the world are separate. We think that we have a transcendent dimension in our faith, that we have a detachment. I've got attachment here, but that's wrong. We have a detachment from the world. But in fact, you see, I'm saying, we have attached ourselves to a particular way of being in the world. In theory, our faith is that we are not tied to the world. Now, I think this raises real questions for us. And I think one of the things that happens when I go through this kind of analysis is that people get very, very pessimistic or down or they despair. Now, I think if my kind of analysis, it doesn't cause me any despair. I don't know why. Maybe it's because it's mine. You know, it's my possession, and so I got something. I got an analysis anyway. But people always tend to react to me as being negative and pessimistic, and I don't know. But if history is unimportant, and I am indicating that our historical life is in trouble, then if we really believe that history is not important, it doesn't matter whether my analysis is negative about our history. Now, when I say you just can't universalize the American way of life, there just aren't enough resources in the world. We have nothing really in the way of a way of life, you know, as a whole, to offer the rest of the world, because they can't adopt it. Physically, it's impossible for 10 billion people, which we'll have in 50 years, to live like we are. It's impossible for 4 billion people to live like, which we have now, to live like we are. Well, that shouldn't be a problem for us if the world is not important. But in a way, the world is very important for us. In spite of our theory, I think, that some of our theory at least, that the sacred and the profane are separate, that faith is one thing and the world is another, we really believe that our way of being in the world is terribly important. Terribly important. Therefore, when it's questioned, the root of our faith, the substance of our faith, is questioned. Now, what might we be? What might we be? Here I follow an analysis which looks at the history of our tradition from the earliest times, that is from the earliest life of Israel to the present, in terms of two covenants, what one writer calls, Kurt Rylestam, an Old Testament scholar, the Shechem Covenant and the Davidic Covenant. And they're just, if you read the Old Testament, this is his interpretation, of course, you find this emphasis in the Shechem Covenant on history, and what God has done beginning with the Exodus, and the covenant with the people. And history is the action of God on behalf of the people of God. And there are obligations which are mutual. And if you don't fulfill your obligations, then you get judgment. If you fulfill them, then God acts on your behalf. And he acts on your behalf in the beginning, in spite of you. He chooses an unknown people as the basis for his covenant. And he continues with his mercy. If you read the Psalms and all the way through, you get this continual struggle between judgment and mercy. And there's a gospel and law. In other words, it's always forgiveness, mercy, and then there's the law. If you don't obey the law, in fact, if anybody in your family, in the tribe doesn't obey the law, then you are subject to the judgments. So that you get grace and demand together. On the other hand, you get the Davidic covenant, in which the focus is on Mount Zion, and God resides on Mount Zion, and God does the work. There's very little emphasis on the covenant in this strand, Rylestam claims. There's a true cosmic order. What's important is what happened in the creation. You have God, the ruler. You have the struggle, I say, between God and Satan, and that takes place kind of above history or at the beginning of history. May take place way in the end, way at the end of history, but it's not this everyday kind of struggle that you get in the other covenant. Now, Rylestam's theory is that you get these two covenants interacting in the Old Testament and also in the New Testament. And one time one will be dominant, the other will be subordinate, but it's always going on, and they're always, never do you get a real integration of them. And it may be that they're very difficult to integrate. One, you get an emphasis upon moving, God moving in history, promising things in history. The other, you get an emphasis upon what God does, what he's done in the past, or what he might do in the far future. You know, focus on what he calls the Alpha, or the beginning, and the Omega, but not upon what's in between. So, and one, you have an emphasis on what is contingent and historical, and the other kind of absolute and primordial, orientation to the future over against orientation to the past, emphasis on human freedom and responsibility, as over against a kind of divine determinism. So that the Bible, and the Hebrew Bible, is an interaction of these two covenants. Now, I'm not going to develop this at great length, but it seems to me that much of our religion in our time has tended, for one reason or another, to take the Davidic line, where there's a kind of action of God above history, and if we can relate ourselves to that, then somehow we as an individual we rise above history. We rise out of history, what's called transcendent dimension. And the other emphasis, which comes in off and on, and Rylsdam says the whole history of Christianity has been an attempt to overcome the eschatological emphasis of the New Testament, in which the historical was played down, and then the history of Christianity is the effort to bring back this other covenant into some integrated position with it. Now, again, I think you have to see my position always as dialectical. Maybe that doesn't help. But what I've been trying to say in regard to these other dimensions is the faith is transcendent in the sense that there's a vertical dimension, and one isn't simply dependent upon what is going to happen in the future. One can live in the present with some relation to the past without always having to think about the future. On the other hand, there's a transcendent dimension that, there's a historical dimension in the sense that one is involved in planning and in programs and in historical actions which have some meaning for the future and make a great deal of difference in terms of where we go. So that we have then a dialectic of the immanent and the transcendent, or the historical and the eschatological. God is acting in and through history. He makes history, but he's more than history. All action then that responds to him is symbolic action. It's participation in his being and in a being in which he acts through us, so that the profane and the sacred cannot be separated. And there's no way to escape God, to put it in terms of Psalm 139. Wherever you go, that is... God is everywhere. It's not a transcendent God, but it's a very immanent God. There's no way to get to God, in a sense, except through history. If you don't love your brother whom you have seen, how can you love God whom you have not seen? Well, that's attempt to deal with I think, a real problem for our faith. And that's the relation of the profane and the sacred. And what I've said in summary is that I think a great many have separated the profane and the sacred in theory. In practice, the profane has given the content for the sacred, and that's a dilemma we face, really face, in our life. And my theory is, if you don't have a theory which relates the profane and the sacred, this is what's liable to happen to you. And that our problem is to hold the profane and the sacred together. Okay, I left the role playing.
Could you illustrate a little more concretely how the profane takes over the sacred, some specific dimension as well?
Well, I made a study of the Layman's Committee of the National Council of Churches, and in their literature, they had all kinds of references to the faith as being personal, having to do with one's personal existence, but not having to do with the world, with the social world. And in their pronouncements at the same time, they had a very definite social philosophy expressed, which they affirmed. So on the one hand, they had a theory that there was no relation to the world. On the other hand, right along with it came the affirmation of a particular understanding of the world. And I've got the sermons in my files at home of people who have the theory that the profane and the sacred are separate, that the church shouldn't be related to the state, that there is no Christian way of looking at economics or politics or the family or education or anything like that. And in the sermon, you simply get, time after time after time, all kinds of illustrations of an understanding of the world which is affirmed as being, it's affirmed, if not explicitly, implicitly, as being a result of your faith. That's just my experience. And that's a kind of a practical, instrumental way of saying, well, if you don't really spell out the meaning of the faith for the profane, this is going to creep in surreptitiously. And let's face it directly. Now, you could still say a theory is better, that the profane and the sacred should be separate. My understanding of God, they couldn't be, but that's a theological problem as to whether there could be any being that exists without God. It isn't a matter of whether you affirm it or not. It isn't a matter of whether God is functioning in this room and with us and through everything we are. It's a matter of whether or not we recognize it, affirm it, or are able to accept it. So he's functioning everywhere and in one way or another. I don't know whether that is any more concrete, Bill. It's like saying that people say, well, you preach against the law and say that there's no real law that applies to you, and then just fill the sermon with law. And I guess what I'm saying is, if you don't have a law, you've got the distinction there as to whether the law is for private matters. I don't know how you separate private and social. I have a real difficulty there. But if it's for private matters over against social matters, then you've got a law. I think it's just as difficult to formulate what it means to be faithful in personal relations as it is in social relations. Just as difficult. They're just as complex and involved and fraught with all kinds of ambiguity.
It's so much a part of, I think, our thought life within the establishment that's one thing that makes it extremely difficult for them to in any way relate the village to their own particular understanding. Like the editor of one of our church papers that just, why all these particular areas of articulation and exposure here at the village? And then I try to capture him for this knowledge within Jesus Christ, all wisdom and knowledge are hidden, and that we are shaped by the Word made flesh, so there can't be anything that's foreign to our interest and curiosity that is involved in being universally human, which we are when we're in Jesus Christ. And he just had a terrible time with me on this. And I can see that my people read our church papers at a terrible time. What is church is what is gospel about who's going where, no Paul had got, who's building a new building. And not that it's the totality of the new humanity involved in our realization of the intensity of being that is God. And I tried to describe this intensity of being, and just I realized what a game place and I quit. But we have laymen who grab it right away. That they can see why we don't have a chapel here, because that is itself symbolic of what it's about. The whole community is the chapel.
Yes, everybody?
Al, how do you fit in a natural law in relationship to either faith? What is natural law?
Karen's asking you, Rudy, what you mean by by natural law.
Yeah, well, what do I mean? I suppose I mean the laws of the universe, and nature, God's physical natural law. This is different from man's laws. And is it in the realm of the profane? And this is where it comes out in nature, you see. It's faith on one side of the fence, nature and the individual, then, as he said, sin to nature, this is in the realm of the profane. I'm just asking a question.
Anybody want to answer it? This is a discussion now. It's not a teacher, you know, it's a discussion. This is the church. Your question is addressed to everybody then, really. What do we do? I'm not quite sure what's behind it.
Well, what would you say if I said that God works through nature and that we are discovering his laws, and therefore they cannot be profane, but they are very sacred?
Well, that's where I would be. But I'm wondering what the church is in relationship to this. Because that's where I have some difficulty in our interpretation of how we view nature. Do we dominate nature? Do we take from nature what we want and have the blessing of the church in doing it? Isn't that what you were saying in relationship to the individual?
Yeah. Well, of course, I was following Carol's, actually, I had a quote from Carol here, from his report to the board of directors, in which he really said what he just said. But if you took the material from the New Testament on Christ as if you take John, where everything was created in and through Christ, and all the way through you get the notion that Christ, as the second person of the Trinity, is the reality of being, of the creation. And if you take that position, then as Karen said, there's no way to separate this profane and have nature somehow, and have a natural law which isn't God's law. There just would be no way to do that. Now, there'd be interpretations of law. There would be our understanding of law, which would be human and subject to all kinds of revisions, as you well know, all kinds of understandings of law. And I think we're beginning to find that that some of these rhythms of nature, which we have broken by virtue of our decisions, are coming back to haunt us. And they are making our physical existence problematic. And therefore, it's a kind of, I interpret as a kind of no. I know you do, that's your interpretation. You interpret as a kind of no to us. And that's where following what we want is over against what we grasp as a created reality, which is given to us, which we respond to and live in terms of, is another perspective. Now, if that's the whole of the creation, it's one thing. If it's some kind of set apartness, it's another thing. And of course, what I'm arguing for is that it is the whole of creation. Yes. And I think you are too.
I am too.
Yeah.
Didn't we adopt the split of the sacred and the profane simply as a device one time in history to zero in more precisely on some characteristics that otherwise we couldn't identify? And so we analyzed, as you did, and you felt you were comfortable for a moment with your analysis. And that maybe instead of throwing rocks at the split, we ought to identify the usefulness of such a dichotomy and then try to identify a synthesis which won't resolve the split. It will simply find maybe what Karen's talking about, in either a more overriding theory or a more solid base which will unify them. But it won't resolve them, won't do away with the sacred and profane as useful identifications of experiences or events. What's the origin of the sacred and profane?
Renaissance thought, isn't it? Who?
Well,
we use it.
But is it classical?
Anybody want to address that early? Historian here?
history started in 1492.
I'm just wondering to what extent it is biblical.
Not.
I can't find anything in
the... Yeah, part of the origin, I would say, is due to the fact that the profane entered when the religious, when the notion that there was a ground and a reality, what we call in philosophical terms being, what we in theological terms God, was denied. And then the split became not only theoretical but practical in terms of the church and the world. That is, the separation occurred because it was thought that some people simply didn't want to be under the influence of those who were functioning out of this kind of an interpretation. And so it gradually got a world which split off. And then you've got a church which is split off, and then you've got continuing theory about it being split off in principle. I don't know whether that's helpful at all.
Well, Archbishop Temple, essay that we all enjoy, called Nature, Man, and God, and it's available, it's a gift of it, who puts putting everything together again in this modern scene, still has this great quip that if it comes to being a world corrupted by the church or church corrupted by the world in power, you got to pick the latter with more hope. And I think that's part of the dichotomy that about a corrupt church who is trying to rule the temporal power. And this is where we have the Western world rebelling against a rule by the ecclesiastical authorities in the name of the unity of scripture between the world and God. I mean, abusing that kind of a overarching doctrine in order to gain political power. It always puts it all together. The earth is the Lord and the fullness thereof is the old covenant statement the new covenant builds on. Never, in any way.
But I think we threw out the baby with the bath.
Yeah, this is the problem.
Yeah. We threw out really the theory of the wholeness or the oneness. The oneness is a better word. That provides us with an opportunity to kind of what I call privatize religion. So it becomes a private matter, not only for a person, but it is in a private realm. It doesn't deal with the social realm, with the public. Public is a better word than social. It deals with our private lives over against the whole of our existence.
That longing for that is it. I think part of the secret of the church's response to this place in the church, which hasn't had too much promotion or support anywhere, but there are enough laymen that respond to this. It's like a French literary critic put it, I think, very well, that all of 20th century literature is a quest for the church. I mean, our realization of the need of wholeness in community and not fragmentation and individual private religion. It's really the overarching heartache, I think, of our age.
Now, I accept the separation of the church and the world as a practical matter, because one has to withdraw in a world in which the sacred is in theory it's denied, and in practice it isn't accepted, although sometimes it's accepted more in practice than it is in theory. I think we have to accept that. Walt Goldman was talking about that in China the other night, that the spirit is present more in theory, less in theory than in practice. In practice it might be there without the symbols and the theory. But, so it's a practical matter. As we withdraw for the sake of thinking through and gathering ourselves together, that it shouldn't be that way, but it's that way because we live in a fallen world, we live in this kind of a situation where the integration, the union is denied, and so you don't separate yourself out because the world is that way, you separate, or life is that way, you separate yourself out for practical reasons. Now that's the theory I hold to, so that it isn't separate because life is separate, it's separate because it's functional to be separate. But I think when Carol said we don't have a church here, you see, as a matter of fact, Holden is a church. it's a separation, in a sense, really, from the world in order to function as well. The whole of holding. So I think the notion that you don't have a church here is symbolically very important, because when we get our separate institutions, and when we don't have our thinking about religion and participating in symbolic life in our schools and so forth, because it creates so many problems, we tend to separate our faith from the world, and that's a very, I think it's a very dangerous thing.
And other cultures, I think, find it impossible to understand this. I got my three beatings from the Japanese Buddhists. The fact that I was an American in the Far East as a missionary meant I was representing our total society and not a religious segment within it. They just couldn't understand it. It didn't have to be the Baptist when they got killed. I think before he was able to make it clear to them, and I told them I knew that Lutheran, and who was Lutheran who was killed, hadn't said the thing they claimed he was, because I said a Baptist couldn't. I said that Baptists and Lutherans are the most adamant on the separation of church and state in our society. They simply couldn't understand them. There was no possibility of a mental handle for them to understand.
Okay, now, how does some of the rest of you, what are you thinking about?
I was going backwards into something you said before about the freedom. Well, it wasn't either. It had to do with discipline. Was it? We were thinking about discipline and what you can do. If you don't have it, and you're only thinking about, if you discipline yourself to do something for other people, or if you're disciplining yourself to do something for yourself, that's, I'm hunting around. But you were talking about the society that puts us in a position where we can't say that Christianity is better than another religion, that Cheerios is better than Wheaties. It's all a matter of our own personal taste. It's okay to have your own personal taste. But then we keep on going and we get into the sacred and the profane, till you get to the place where you say, so somebody's hopped up, that's for them. Good health foods, that's for me. And then you say, okay, as an individual, if I'm hopped up, I'm not hurting anybody but me, and who the hell cares? But the problem with it is that the Christian does care. And then we get clear all the way around to the Christian health freak.
You mean imposing his standards on somebody else?
Yeah. And where do you get off the greed for your own personal self and your own Christian? It isn't your own Christian. It's God's Christian. And you can't separate your own self from the society in which you live, try though we all do.
Depends on why you're separating yourself.
Yes, it does.
I think you can separate yourself some. I think we have to live on the edge in most institutions, and if we're free, that's what we're doing. We're not withdrawing from them. I don't know where you go. They're everywhere. I certainly have to live on the edge of my institution. There's no way to live in it with any wholehearted support for it, and it's a religious institution in theory. It's, a divinity school. But you did raise a question, I don't know whether this is what you meant to, of freedom and discipline. It's a very, very tricky question, a very important question as to how you deal with a society which is, if it's as idolatrous as I say it is, and it is influencing all of us, it's conditioning our kids, you can't avoid. You talk about subliminal influences and all those kinds of things, and the use of Skinner for behavior mod in the schoolroom, and you know, half the teachers are using behavior mod to what? To discipline the kids or get the kids to do what they, the teachers, want them to do. And maybe it's good, maybe it's indifferent. I don't know a lot of the time. But so the question is whether, you know, freedom, as a freedom for everybody to do what he pleases, is set over against some understanding of values and what a society ought to be like and how you order it and what its substance is, what the symbol systems are, what the educational content is. And there just is no formula. I guess what I'm saying is that the image that we let a society go on and simply follow the individual wishes of all of its members, in some ways is a very good thing. If you are where I am, it's almost that which gives you freedom to get out of it, because you are free to form your own schools and to do your own thing, and so you may say, great, let it go that way, but understand that that's a very demonic kind of a theory that's not the one I'm going to follow. And in our Christian communities, we as Christian communities are going to try together to formulate a way, a vision of humanity, of the fullness of God for personhood, which we then try to embody. With all the problems, it's the reflecting, responding community seeking to shape its life in accordance with its created, given humanity. A lot of words, but what it means is the church has simply got to do a lot of work in reflecting on what it means to be faithful, and begin to form some protective devices and some opening devices. It's like the lifestyle program here during the winter is an opening device, but it's also a protective device. People are in a community with a very definite lifestyle and content for 9 months, and things happen that wouldn't happen, I think, if you didn't have both the protection and the opening. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you form that around a... How does a congregation become that? That's a great issue for us. How a congregation becomes a kind of thing. I guess all of this I'm trying to say is there's a lot you have to be protected from. There's a lot of opening, and there's a lot of nurturing that has to go on about the whole world. You just can't send somebody to college and think college is going to educate a person. It won't. It won't. And so what we really need are communities of faith that work with people who are trying to get an education, helping them ask the questions and find out almost how you beat the college. That is to say, how you use the college. Blacks know how to do it, man. They come into your school and they just use you. They don't buy into what you're doing. And since they're black now, most of the time they can get away with it. They get all kinds of special programs, all kinds of special privileges for them. And they know it. And they're not buying into what's going on because they see, as a lot of students do, that the education a lot of the time is not asking the questions or addressing the issues that are crucial. So I say, you know, I spend my time helping students, in a sense, find a way of getting an education in spite of the college. In spite of it. Now maybe you have to live in spite of our culture. Yeah.
Living on the fringe or the edge of our institutions, yeah. Finding ways to work within them in your own.
Well, for the time being, it may be that you will, you know, you might have some withdrawal, but you know, where are you going to withdraw? With your skills and your abilities, there isn't a place to withdraw to, which is trying to move into the culture with a new vision. So we have to find ways of supporting each other and sustaining each other. Now, that's one of the things we're trying to get if Pauline moves to, he's going to move, he and Julie are going to move to Ballard, and I think we will. I don't know what Sarah thinks, but I think we will move there in 78 when I retire.
To
and
where?
To Ballard in Seattle, and try to form a community within the city which reflects what Holden is. So you get the support. Now, if you were teaching at University of Washington or something like that, and Paul was teaching there, And we had our community, and then we had a group, growing group of students who were involved in the community who were also going. You know, you would have a supportive kind of thing, and you work together on all kinds of ways. I don't know any other way to do it, Joanne.
I'm going to ask Paul to talk about that night during the dance. We're going to have a Monday night forum, but I thought he'd just, you know, he doesn't have to do the dance the whole time.
Oh, I'd like to have it when I come.
Yeah, well, we're going to have it Monday night.
Monday night, too.
For the full forum.
Yeah. Well, it's time for this next session, so let's officially adjourn.